When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Ash Regan, who's standing to be the next leader of the SNP and the next First Minister of Scotland. Obviously, Kate Forbes was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and Ash is on the show today. Before I come on to that, just to let you know, my next guests at the live shows at the Duchess Theatre in London are as follows. On the 20th of March, I'm joined by Channel 4 News' Krishnan Gurumurthy, one of the most talented broadcasters in the country. On the 3rd of April, I'm joined by the former leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Ruth Davidson, and that will be just a few days after the SNP have chosen their new leader, so that'll be a great night to discuss Scottish politics. On the 17th of April, the megastar that is Jess Phillips. On the 22nd of May, the new Labour heavyweight that is David Blunkett. On the 5th of June, former Chancellor Philip Hammond, who gives very few interviews, so that will be a real rare opportunity to see one of the most influential people in the Conservative Party in the country up close and personal, live and direct at the Duchess Theatre. You can get tickets for all those shows by clicking the link that I've put in the blurb. On to today's show with Ash Regan, who's been thrust into the spotlight. I guess all three of the candidates have, but her I always try and find a polite word. They're opponents, really, in this term, aren't they? But I always try and say colleagues or... because people are in the same party and they're running against each other. But obviously in this contest, they're opponents, even if they're friendly with each other. Whereas Kate Forbes and Humza Yousaf perhaps had a bit more profile, Humza Yousaf especially before the contest. Ash Regan has done this with a little less profile. So we do talk about that at the start, just almost a way the culture shock of being all of a sudden in a battle to be the next leader of the country in which you live. It's a big deal. We also talk in detail about Ash's plans for independence, for what if Westminster says no to her plan and her plan to refresh the SNP, and just a lot of other stuff about the culture of the party, the things that she thinks needs to change, the way that the SNP would make the case for independence if she was leader, and a whole lot of other stuff as well. And it's always interesting to talk to people who are in a leadership contest, because the rest of the time, obviously, there's a sense of collective responsibility. In a leadership contest, people still have their loyalties, but in a leadership contest, you really get a sense of more where people stand, because they're telling you more about what they really believe. And you get a sense of what are the different wings within a political party and where is the centre of gravity within a party. And obviously, as we talk about, other political parties have been through this a lot more regularly, the Labour Party and the Tory Party, obviously. And then you always get that it tells you where the membership is. And that's what's so fascinating about this, that really, this is the first time for a very long time, because Nicola Sturgeon was effectively elected unopposed, that the SNP has had a leadership contest. It's a real unique opportunity to test the opinion of the members of the party that run Scotland. So there's a whole load in this, and I will now stop prattling on and enjoy Ash Regan. Delighted to be joined by Ash Regan, who's standing to be the next leader of the SNP, the next First Minister of Scotland. Ash, I mean, the last couple of weeks must have been a whirlwind for you. Are you enjoying the process of standing for the leadership?
It has been a whirlwind, I think probably more for me than for the others, because I did not go into politics. You know, I got elected in 2016 and I didn't go in there with my, I think some people go in, right? I'm not giving away trade secrets here, but some people go in and you can clearly see from the beginning, they've got their eye on that top job and they maneuver and they do certain things in order to get themselves into that position. I'm not going to name any names here, but I think you might have an idea of who I'm talking about. Anyway, I never did that. I mean, you can tell that from my social media output, you know, from things I got involved in. I just did my job and went home and lived my life, you know. I got to the point, though, I mean, obviously, you'll know all the stuff that went in over the gender reform and everything. And I started to feel that the leadership, my view of the leadership, was that we'd lost our way on a few things. We were starting to get into territory where the public were losing trust and respect in the government. And then by extension, that was damaging our chances of independence. And so you sit there and you think, right, well, if I think this, and then you look around and you think, who's going to go forward? And we had an idea of who might go forward. And I just thought, I think that we need to go in a different direction here. And I wasn't sure that the other people that would put themselves forward would want to do what needed to be done. So that's how I found myself in this contest, because I knew that I wanted to do things in a different way, and I wasn't sure that anyone else would want to do what I wanted to do. So I found myself in this, and some of it's enjoyable, but obviously other parts of it, it's, I haven't had any time off until this morning for weeks now. So this was the first morning that I actually had a long lie, and I was able to, have breakfast. It has just been just constant. And obviously, I'm probably giving you too long an answer here, but obviously, when people are now, they're quite frustrated with us, I think, that we haven't got the detail and we haven't set out full policy platforms. But the contest was so short, just really a week or two to kind of get that stuff arranged. It's just not possible to set out that level of detail. And also, we don't have access. Well, I don't have access to, teams of civil servants or advisors or anything like that. I've got basically got three volunteers and one paid staffer, because the budget's really little. It's like £5,000. You can't do a lot with that. So that was kind of a long answer to your short question.
No, it's a great answer. And obviously, it's one thing to sit there as a politician, even one that hasn't been sort of as near to the sort of, I suppose, the government level that some of your, the other two candidates might be. But you're just an MSP, you're a full-time politician. To sit there and think, I can do a better job than these people, it's then another to take that step and put yourself forward. And obviously, you're all of a sudden having to do TV debates against people who are your colleagues, people that, of course, you'll have disagreement with, but no, that is a ferocious, piercing spotlight to be under. And it's a lot of pressure on you individually. I mean, you've gone from being an MSP to all of a sudden being live on the telly, it feels like every night, effectively having to attack your colleagues. I mean, that must be quite a hard thing to all of a sudden be doing.
It is a hard thing to all of a sudden be doing. And also, if you think about it, I haven't had any training for this. In the SNP, we don't do any. The party does no training for MSPs when they first get elected. The Parliament gave us a couple of hours of training for like media training or speech writing or whatever. But obviously for me that was 2016. So you kind of just learn on the job. And obviously if you haven't done as much media, you won't have as much experience in doing that. So I would definitely, I'm less well known than the other two, and I've definitely had less experience of operating at that level of media scrutiny. Now, obviously, it's something you can learn to get better at. I've had to learn to get better at this literally within days. So it's been a very steep learning curve, but I'm learning that I can do it. So I suppose that's something.
And is it difficult for you because only SNP members can vote in this, but obviously the whole country, I mean, not just the whole of Scotland, the UK is watching, and of course people elsewhere. And you've got to pitch to members who were very keen on the person who's just gone, while simultaneously offering change, which means distancing yourself from the person they really like. I mean, that's quite a difficult tightrope for all three of you to walk.
It is, but so that we're not all on the same page on that. So obviously, Hamza is very much presenting himself as, the continuity candidate. So that's, he's very much in the camp saying nothing's wrong. We have no issues as a party. Everything's fabulous, and I'll just keep going the way we've been going. Well, I don't agree with that, and I think we can see we've lost a lot of members over the last, recent while, and a lot of them have written to me and told me why they've left. And so I think there are issues that need to be addressed. So I think you have to be able to, because we were getting a lot of stick, I think, last week. Particularly Kate was getting it for kind of questioning Hamza at that first TV debate, in a way that perhaps the opposition might have spoken about him. But we're in a contest, and people are in it to win it, and you don't agree with necessarily the positions that the other candidates have put forward, or you think there's massive holes in their arguments, for instance. So you have to be able to have that contest. We can't all just sit there, and kind of accepting. So I was very clear that we have to be able to set out an alternate vision of where we would want to go, and that would include pointing out where you think we've made mistakes. So yes, we all think Nicola's an amazing politician. But I think we're at the point now where we have to go in a different direction, or that's how certainly how I feel about it. Obviously, other candidates have different views on that. But yeah, I think it's been a bit of I think it's certainly true to say it's been a bit of a shock to the system for the party. We're a party of intense levels of self-discipline, and we haven't had a contest like this for a very long time. And I think some people are genuinely quite shocked by seeing us arguing with each other. But, you know, I mean, the Tories are used to this. They do this all the time. You know, Labour has a new leader every 5 to 6 months. They manage that process okay. So it's just because we're not used to it, I think.
I think that's what it is, actually. And I wonder if actually that's something for the party to reflect on, that the iron discipline thing actually came at a huge price, that you weren't allowed external dissent where the public actually expects. They know that the Tories are split, not just on Europe, but on various things, that there's a more liberal and a more conservative wing. They know that within the Labour Party, there are Blairites and Corbynistas. And yet, in a way, for a period of time, the SNP seems to have pretended that there are no wings, when actually, of course, there are. And yeah, it's perfectly healthy to have them. And I wonder if you're successful, whether you would allow a bit more open public debate about any issue than perhaps previous leaders have allowed.
Yes, well, that certainly is one of my issues with the way the party's been run laterally, was the lack of democracy at the party level. You know, the difficulty for ordinary branches getting, I mean, this is getting into sort of SNP governance, whatever, but the difficulty that they were telling me they were having with getting things onto the agenda to be discussed at conference. You know, it was an iron grip on that. The fact that, you know, the party structure had been changed a lot recently. So just to give you an example, the leadership contest in the constitution used to be 4 months. That used to be the timetable set out for that. And it got changed. They were actually, someone from who's on the current NEC said to me on Saturday that they were trying to make this contest 2 weeks, and that he and a few others then said, hang on, this is ridiculous, and got it up to 3 weeks. Now, you know, I mean, this is what I was trying to say last night when I was getting put under pressure about not being able to answer certain questions, is that, you know, obviously we're appealing to SNP members here, but this is not like a contest to be the leader of the Liberal Democrats in Scotland, right, where you've got 4 seats. We are the dominant, you know, political force in Scotland, and the person that wins this will go on to become the First Minister. This is a different level of scrutiny, you know, where we should have full transparency and everything. It should all be accountable to give people the trust and confidence in this process. You know, trying to do that over such a few weeks, personally, I don't think it's appropriate. I mean, I'm in it, and I'm working to the timeframes and everything I've been given, but this would not be my preference. And I think it's inappropriate for something as important as this to be carried out in the way that it has been.
And why do you think the people in charge of the process, and perhaps we can come on to who they are, have preferred a shorter campaign?
I couldn't tell you, other than perhaps there's a need to steady the ship in some way, and we need to get a new leader in position fast, or Nicola wants to leave very quickly. Maybe she wants to. I don't know. I think we can only speculate. I don't know the answers.
I mean, obviously, you can see all sides of this. Sometimes when leadership contests are prolonged, parties say, oh my God, we're going to spend the whole summer tearing each other to shreds. We can't have that. But as you say, you are the party of government, so there has to be a sense that the candidates at least have left Edinburgh for a couple of days and gone somewhere else for a debate, and that, you know, that the whole country can see what's happening. Obviously, the chief exec of the SNP is Peter Murrell, the husband of Nicola Sturgeon. People meet at work, they fall in love, that's life. But it does make it odd when, obviously, this is a political party and the process itself is political. If there's a perceived favoured candidate, and let's be honest, that would probably be Humza Yousaf.
Yeah.
And you've got the person, the political colleagues that are married to each other. I mean, I know you have concerns over that. I mean, it does seem strange. You use the analogy about Carrie Johnson and Boris Johnson, that in a way, would it not have been better for the party to hand this over to someone else, or for Peter Morrill to have resigned when Nicola Sturgeon did and say, I'm not going to be part of this process?
Absolutely, it would have. You know, and that's why I think there is a level of concern about the way the process is being carried out. You know, and I'm being accused of, you know, getting my excuses in or whatever, but I think that's really inappropriate to be saying that. I think we all understand that, like, because what we've just set out, that this person is going to become the First Minister. You know, there's a level of scrutiny on this process that wouldn't necessarily be there. And, you know, it's being run in the same way. We have internal selection contests all the time for, you know, office bearers at the national level, and also for what we would call a selection contest, you know, to become the candidate to stand in an election, whether that's council, you know, MSP or MP level. And we run them all the time. It's the same company that we use for all of this. So no one is suggesting that there's anything wrong with the company, or that, you know, there's, you know, that things are being done in a way that they shouldn't be. But what we are saying is that in order to give that level of assurance in the trust in the process, that what I've called for, and I think Kate's team might be, you know, starting to say the same things now, because I had a quick chat with Michelle Thompson last night, who's working on Kate's team. And I think she was going to put out something this morning about having an auditor. So trade union ballots, I think, have to be audited by an independent I don't know if it's an independent observer or an independent company or something, but we don't have that in this process. So I think that's definitely a gap there. Yes, personally, I think Peter should have recused himself from the oversight of this, and I think we should use an independent company, you know, not a company that we normally use. So it's a completely fresh, different one. And we should have a neutral observer who's overseeing the process. And then everyone would have, you know, everyone, it would be transparent and everyone would have complete confidence in it. So at the moment, my feeling is the membership don't have confidence in this process. So even if that's a perception and that perception is wrong, the way to counter that is to obviously enhance the transparency of the process.
And what about relations between the three of you? Are you friendly with each other backstage? Do you talk to each other?
Yeah, Kate. So I'll be completely honest. Kate and I are friends and have been friends for many years now. But Hums and I would say we're colleagues. You know, we have a good civil relationship. We've worked together closely in the past, but we wouldn't call each other pals or buddies or anything like that.
And you obviously resigned from the government over gender reform. It's become a huge issue. Undoubtedly, one of the things that hastened Nicola Sturgeon's departure. I just wonder about where Scottish public opinion is and where SNP members' opinion is compared to perhaps where Nicola Sturgeon's opinion was. Do you think Nicola Sturgeon on that issue was out of step? I mean, she was clearly out of step with the Scottish public, but do you think she was out of step with the membership as well?
I do, yeah, absolutely do. I mean, I think there's been some opinion polling on this, and if we just use the term progressive, I know that doesn't sum it up, but just, you know what I mean. I think the audience will know what I'm talking about. I think the SNP are slightly more progressive than the general public, but even within the SNP, I would say that the, you know, self-ID and many of the things that are associated with that, and if we also widen that out to trans prisoner allocation, etc., they're more in step with the general public's views on this than they are with the leadership's.
I guess there's a danger, actually, that and this is where the previous leader or the current leader became unstuck, is actually people perceive that the changes weren't progressive, that they were being enacted by people who perceived them to be and believe themselves to be progressive, and in other areas undoubtedly are. But these reforms themselves actually felt regressive. These felt like an attack on women's rights. These felt like a step back rather than a step forward.
Yeah, I think they are. And I obviously made that case. But I also think that if you look at, you know, the way we're treating, you know, trans children in particular, and I don't know if you've seen the sort of interim cash review, but there is some suggestion in there that, you know, we are not safeguarding you know, particularly gay children by kind of forcing them down this medical route. So I would also possibly think there's an argument to be made there that the way we're approaching this issue could even be homophobic as well as sexist. So yeah, it's a whole can of worms.
I mean, whatever happens next will be fascinating. You've got, I don't know, what, 3 weeks left? 2 weeks left?
2 weeks, yeah. Just under 2 weeks, I think it is, yeah.
And what's your sense of...
I mean, you've frozen a bit there.
Oh no, have I? Have I unfrozen now?
I missed a little bit of what you said before you said.
Shall I retake it? What's your sense of where you are in the running at this stage of the contest?
And there's absolutely no way to tell. That's the thing. I asked to know what the current membership figures were, and I wasn't given a number. There's obviously been some speculation in the press. I think the party have said that the membership figures, I think, are 78,000. So we're not entirely sure, because obviously that means we've lost a lot of members. So I think we're down 50,000. So it's very difficult to tell because we don't have the information, you know, what the demographic makeup is of the party membership right now. So we don't know. So it's very difficult to tell. And I think the media, I think, are having trouble a little bit with this as well, because there's such an interest from the public, because the person's going to be the first minister. You know, they're interested in what, you know, the general public think, but actually the general public don't get a vote. You know, it's just the SNP membership. And I would say even the membership of the SNP will have different views to SNP voters. You know, it's a very distinct category of people who obviously have, you know, certain views about things. And I would say they, you know, have strong views on progress towards independence, for instance, as being a key issue for them. So if I'm right about that, I should have a very high level of support.
So, but surely if you're a candidate in an election like this, and this may feel like an internal question, but actually this is really important. Surely you should be able to get the data on how many members you have, because you've got to contact them directly.
We're not allowed to contact them directly. So in a normal selection contest, and I've been in several, so I have a good basis of understanding for this, you would get what we would call like emails to the membership. So last time I stood There was a constituency of the, it was something like 1700 members, and I got multiple emails, as did all the other candidates, to speak to them directly, send links, photos, biograph, anything you wanted to send them to make your case about why they should vote for you. But in this contest, we haven't been given that. We haven't been able to contact the members directly at all.
And what's the reason for that?
I haven't been given a reason.
But that seems, I mean, every other selection process I've been aware of, can't, the whole point is that members would want you to contact them.
Well, of course I would. And the other thing is, as well, that obviously I can see I've got a good level of support on social media, but not all the members are on social media. I want to have an opportunity to talk to other members and set out my stall, if you like, which I would love to do through an email. Even if I got one email, I could set out, here's me talking about certain things on Radio 4, here's, and then this is the argument about this, this is my independent strategy or whatever. And I can't do that to everyone. And the voting started because we haven't been given that facility, which is, so it's highly unusual. I will say that it's highly unusual not to be able to contact the membership, the people that are voting in any way. Usually you also get phone numbers and you're able to phone people. Again, if we had that data, I have teams of people across the country who would be more than willing to make 50 phone calls each for me. And we're not allowed to do that either. So it's a very unusual contest. It's very unusual.
But is there even like a sort of centrally coordinated thing where you send your mail shot to head office and they send it to the membership for you?
No, not as far as I'm aware. So what they have done is they've put up a statement from each of us on that you can access, I think, from, when you go in to vote, you can click and read what people have said. And there's a photograph. Now, they did record a video of all of us about a week ago, and they said they were going to send that video and that that would go out with the ballots. But I haven't received that video yet, but I see Hamza's is up now. I don't know what's happening.
I can't believe that in a contest to pick any party leader in Britain in 2023, that you wouldn't be able to target, you wouldn't be able to talk to the people who are able to
No,
vote for you.
let's just say very, very unusual situation that we're in. And I feel like it's not appropriate to not be able to contact the members, because then you're filtering all this then, aren't you? So the membership can obviously watch TV, but TV debates, I mean, the first two, it was sound bites. We weren't getting into the substance of it. I would say the last one was very much sort of filtered through a sort of a UK vision of what Scotland is. So that maybe that's not that helpful either. So they've got that to go on. If they're on social media, they can obviously access people's websites and Twitter and things like that, and you can look at that. And then the rest of it's the newspapers, which is again all filtered through a certain prism. Okay, we have the national newspaper, but everything else, I mean, they're twisting everything you say. So I make one comment, and then I'm very surprised by then how I see it represented in the newspapers. So that's not giving people a sort of a fair way to set out their stall and then let people judge. Based on what you're saying, it's sort of filtered through what people think you're saying, or they think you might have said, so we're back to all that. So it's very difficult.
Well, let this podcast episode be the only place, the only place that you can say exactly what you think, and it will go purely into members' ears. Obviously, other people will be listening as well. I think it was on the Channel 4, or was it Sky last night? You said that you were the only candidate with a published plan for legally achieving independence, a plan for if Westminster says no, and a plan to improve the SNP. So, this is effectively your manifesto. So, let's get into it. What is your plan for legally achieving independence?
So, I mean, this is one of the key points I think we're at, where we're at. I feel we're at a crossroads, really, where we've been doing, and it's not entirely our fault because we're working to the system that we've been given. So we're obviously in a situation where we've been winning elections, trying to use that as a moral mandate to then ask for a referendum. And the UK government, as it is in their gift to then say no, that they were not going to give us a referendum. But it's been quite a long time now since the last referendum. So I don't think it's unreasonable to want to ask the Scottish public again. Maybe they have a different opinion on this than they did last time, especially because of all the things that have been happening. So it's been quite a busy time. We've had Brexit and we've had a cost of living crisis and we've had, Liz Truss disastrously in charge of the economy for 15 minutes, which, ruined everyone's mortgages. So there's a lot been going on. And I think it's entirely appropriate to be able to, certainly if you're in the SNP, to want to ask the Scottish public again about that. And also, if you look at Northern Ireland, obviously they've got a different arrangement there. And they wrote into that the potential to have another, to have a border poll every 7 years if that was, requested, and if rising support showed that it, was possible to do that, where we don't have that facility. So what I'm suggesting is that because lots of countries have become independent, I'm not talking about ones that have left the UK or the British Empire, but in a wider context, most of them don't use referendums. Referendums, it's one way to do it, but it's not the way to do it necessarily. And what's a referendum based on? It's just based on an election, isn't it? It's based on the ballot box. So this is what I'm suggesting is that we use what we have access to, and all we have access to, without if we don't get permission from Westminster to do it, is the normal elections that we'd have in Scotland. So obviously the next one is probably going to be the next general election, and then the one after that would be the next Scottish election. And so what I'm suggesting is that we use that just as a trigger. We set out very clearly in the SNP manifesto that this isn't from any kind of mandate. This is literally to begin negotiations to leave the UK, and everyone knows what they're voting for. And we can also be joined by other pro-anti parties. So, if the Green Party want to put it in their manifesto, if ALBA wants to put it in their manifesto, if ISP and so on, any party that wants to join in is obviously, we'd be welcome to do that. And then if we get, the trigger point obviously is 50% plus one, but I would, and I'm not, that's the minimum, right? So I would like it to be much higher, but I'm saying that that would represent a majority. And the other thing is, I think to remember is that this used to be SNP policy, but it used to be based on majority of seats. So I'm going further, setting a higher hurdle and saying it should be majority of votes cast. And in the 90s, and I think in the 80s, I'm going a while back now, because Thatcher said, this was legitimate, it was acceptable, because it was democratic. So I'm suggesting that when what's happening at the moment is the UK is preventing Scotland expressing its will because it doesn't want Scotland to say it wants to leave the UK, right? So it's using the mechanisms it has available to it to say, we just won't let Scotland choose. I'm saying that's not acceptable and that Scotland shouldn't be held hostage in this way. And let's use what we have. And should Scotland express that democratic mandate, I believe the UK will accept that.
Isn't there a danger that actually the Scottish public's view is they want the SNP to run Scotland, but they don't want to be independent? And that's the conundrum that Nicola Sturgeon wasn't able to solve. And that fundamentally, that's where opinion is.
I don't think that's the case. I think there are people who feel like that. Definitely, there are. But I think there's a lot there. I think that, roughly, I would say we are about 50-50. I know the polls go up and down, so we've been over 50, and sometimes we're a bit under 50. I think we're a bit under 50 at the moment. I think that's obviously because, there's a leadership contest going on right now. We haven't been making the case for independence for a really long time. So there's, I think fresh leadership could, go a long way to resolving that and getting it back to around the 50% or more, ideally. But I think that, if you look, Scotland, I want Scotland to running its own affairs. I think many people do. And, there's a lot of issues in Scotland that we have not been able to resolve under devolution. And I think that that doesn't show that, Scotland is rubbish at running its own affairs. To me, it says that the devolution settlement is designed in order to keep, sort of to mean that these problems are almost impossible to solve. So if we look at, child poverty's come up a lot, and it's a scandal. If Scotland was an independent country, we'd be something like the 15th richest country in the world. In the world, right? So there's no reason for kids in Scotland to be going to bed hungry and cold, right? But they are. Now, we've spent millions and millions of pounds, the Scottish government, mitigating what we see as, disastrous economic policy coming from Westminster. So we spend lots of money mitigating that, and yet we are still not budging. Essentially, I mean, we have slightly better child poverty rates than the rest of the UK, but it's still not acceptable, right? So to my mind, don't just carry on with what we've got and just say, oh, well, devolution's, we need another party in charge. I don't fundamentally don't think that will work. I think what this is showing is that we need ambitions for Scotland that go beyond devolution, and that is how we're going to solve some of these problems, primarily by getting the Tories away from managing the economy, would be my first suggestion.
I mean, some people might say then people have to vote Labour at the general election. That's the only way to do it.
I think it's looking very likely that, Labour will win the next election. And perhaps we might end up in a, we might not be in the same political stalemate. I mean, I think Keir Starmer is saying that he also wouldn't grant a referendum. But, historically, I think the Labour Party have, well, at least in recent times anyway, have been more, I feel, have been slightly more sympathetic to democracy and to Scotland expressing its will. But we'll see. I personally don't think that, having Labour in at the UK level is going to save us all. But, people are entitled to that view if they like.
And what's your plan if Westminster says no to your plan?
Yeah, so I've set out, it's quite a long document, and it's basically based on what I'm calling, it's sort of four pillars, if you like, of how it would work. So the first one is that, we live in a democracy, and we're in a democratic culture where, democratic outcomes are recognized, and they have been. So, the elections in Scotland are run by the same electoral commission that runs the one in the UK. So I think we'd be getting into a very dangerous situation if we had UK government ministers which were suggesting that they wouldn't recognize the outcome of an election in Scotland. So I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is obviously, there's international law. The Scottish ministers have spent quite a lot of time, abroad talking to other countries and setting out, Scotland's position. And I think there's a large amount of sympathy for Scotland internationally. And I think they would recognize the democratic mandate coming from Scotland in that way. Then we've got the opportunity that we could choose the timing of our own election. So at the moment we have the fixed term parliament, but it's possible. I went to see the parliamentary clerks about this, and one of my MP colleagues did the same down south. And we can pass a bill that will change so that we can remove the two-thirds majority needed in order to call an election. So it would just go to a simple majority. So that means that we could choose the timing of the next election. So that might be useful as well. I'm not suggesting that we would, call an election tomorrow or anything like that. I don't think that's appropriate, but I think it's good to have that facility should we need to use it in the future. So you could then use a Scottish election for the purposes that I've set out for the voter empowerment mechanism. And then the final one is that obviously we're a constitutional monarchy. So the First Minister would be required to attend audiences with the King, who is the head of state. And, you'd be a member of the Privy Council, et cetera. So I think if the UK was going to be ill-advisedly not recognize what Scotland has chosen democratically, there would be an opportunity, obviously, to bring that up with the head of state as well. And I think that the UK, whoever was in charge of the UK, would probably be very unwise let it get to that sort of situation, if you see what I mean.
But do your instincts tell you that the king would be sympathetic to Scottish independence or not?
Well, I've looked at some speeches that he's made recently. And I feel he is. He talks about, the long road to self-governance and self-determination being a goal and all that. So I think he would. Also, you've got to remember, he is, the royal family in general, I think, holds the people of Scotland in very high regard. They love to spend time in Scotland, and I think they understand the Scottish people. So no, I don't think they would want to stand in the way of Scottish self-determination either.
Is there not a problem with the whole plan that actually it's the Scottish public that would be perhaps the most offended, where they'd say, look, you can't, once you've established, having had a referendum in 2014, obviously a Brexit one in 2016, that there is certainly in the modern era, we say, well, constitutional things like this are settled by referendums, and that's only fair. That it's not fair to take my vote for my local MP or MSP and effectively misrepresent it in that way. I want you to represent me at a local or a national level, but I'm not keen on independence. That actually this would cause a whole load of unintended consequences between the party's relationship with its own public and some of its own supporters.
Well, it is true to say, that there are people who vote SNP who don't want Scottish independence. That is fair. That's true. I know that to be the case. So, but I think if it's set out in the manifesto and it's in line one of the manifesto for us and for others, and obviously the parties that don't want independence can have the reverse, vote for us to not, then everyone knows what they're voting for. It's be very clear. So if you're in the percentage of people that vote SNP but don't want independence for that election, you will know, you'll no doubt choose to use your vote in another way.
Isn't there something unsatisfying about that, though? Wouldn't you rather have a referendum, win it fair and square, and ultimately you'd want a referendum, and a referendum is more likely to be granted when there is a consistent majority of the Scottish public who want it. And the problem is that that's just never been achieved, and that's the
Well,
part of the problem that's the issue, not
yeah, I don't
Westminster.
agree with that. I think I don't have any confidence in the idea that if we were consistently polling, let's say 53%, that Westminster would turn around and give us a referendum.
But would
I
you
just
want one? I mean, for you, wouldn't it be more sensible
yes.
to
I
get
mean,
it
if
to
they were
60
gonna
so they could win
yes,
it?
yeah. If Rishi rang me up later, he'll obviously watch the podcast, and he'll ring me up and he'll be like, Ash, I will give you a referendum. I'll be like, Rishi, great. Come fly to Edinburgh. Let's do the paperwork. But it's, Matt, do you really think that that's going to happen? It's not going to happen. So yes, of course I would. Of course I would take that. But what I'm saying is that what I'm setting out is based on watching this strategy fail for year after year after year. And my view is that, you know, there is international law, self-determination, you know, it's an established concept, and that if the Scottish people want to express a view on this, they should be allowed to do that. That's, you know, that's fundamentally where I'm coming from, is that this is a democratic choice that should be offered to Scotland. I believe that many people have watched in dismay, you know, some of the stuff that's happened over the last 9 years, you know, and fundamentally things have changed beyond recognition. You know, many people believed the No campaign and thought that they were voting against Scotland becoming independent to protect their place in the EU. Well, look how that turned out. So, you know, people have got a right to be able to revisit this situation and maybe think differently about it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So just to be clear then, if Westminster says no, what do you do?
Well, just obviously, I personally think it'd be democratic outrage, you know, if Scotland votes for this and they don't recognise it. Because if you think about it, just reverse it in your mind a little bit. If we, let's say we got 53% in 2014, and then the UK government just said, oh, well, we're not going to recognise that. You know, there'd be outrage. So I don't think it'll come to that. I think in all the countries where, so now if I talk about the ones that have left the British Empire, UK, all the countries and the peaceful ones, you know, the UK started off saying no, but eventually they did say yes. So I think we just have to recognise there will be bluster here, and they will say they won't negotiate. But I think eventually, I think they will. I don't think you can stand in against democracy like that. If Scotland has shown strongly that it wants to leave the UK, I think they should be allowed to do that. And I don't think the UK should stand by and force Scotland to stay in. It's not a credible long-term situation, I don't think, to be forcing people to stay as part of your, what we're always being told, aren't we? It's a voluntary state. So if it is voluntary, we should be able to express a desire to not be part of it anymore.
Is there a danger that actually, in a leadership contest, you have to differentiate yourself from your counterpart? So in a way, if one person's saying, actually, I'm going to do it in a more gradual way, you've got to say, well, I'll go further. I'll deliver independence faster. Actually, do you really think this is credible, or are you having to say it because you're in a leadership contest?
I don't have to say it. I mean, the other two are not saying that they'll do this. You know, they're saying, well, I'm not really sure what they're saying. It does change a little bit. It has changed a little bit as the weeks have gone on. And they're certainly talking, let's just put it this way, they're certainly talking about independence more than they would be if I wasn't in this contest. So I'm certainly leading the debate to an extent on issues like independent strategy, on issues like infrastructure, the currency question, all of this. You know, had I not been in this debate, we wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be talking about this. Now, it's perfectly legitimate to be, you know, in, you know, at the beginning, we were talking about wings of the party, weren't we? And there's always this thing in the SNP that we have the gradualist wing and we have the fundamentalist wing. So it's entirely appropriate that maybe in this contest, we have representations of the gradualist wing and the fundamentalist wing. So, you know, so it's out there. So people can listen to everyone's what they're setting out and they can decide, you know, do they think the gradual approach is going to work? Or are they fed up with the gradual approach and they want to try something else? And that's, you know, only the members can decide that for themselves.
And do you think actually, obviously, Alex Salmond was one of the great gradualists, that people like him and people who are sort of, you know, would still admire him within the party actually are coming to a more fundamentalist position.
Yeah,
people have been.
Well, they are.
Journey.
I mean, Nicola was suggesting, wasn't she, towards the end there, that she was going to put a de facto referendum to conference. I think a de facto referendum, I haven't actually checked, but I think that might be what Alex Salmond is suggesting. So that's not what I'm suggesting. It is slightly different. I mean, it's similar, but it's not exactly the same. And the other thing about mine is that it would be each and every election. So it's not a one-off, you know, the de facto referendum is a one-off. And I don't think that's appropriate for the next general election, because I think, like we're talking about Labour versus Tory, cost of living, energy and so on, the public, you know, are, this is not probably the top of their list. They've got other things they want to talk about. So I think single issue elections at this time, at the time we're in at the moment with this sort of economic mess that the UK's in, is not wise, is how I would put it. But yes, so I think, you know, we're working through scenarios, aren't we? And if you're going, it's like you're in a maze and you're going down and you're going down and you keep turning corners and then you get to the end and it's blocked. You've got to retrace your steps and then think, right, I'm going to go in a different direction. So I'm just putting out what I see as a possible solution to this. And it's up to the membership to decide if they want a leader who's going to try that. So I suppose I would summarize my position as being a bit less passive. I'm not accepting that Westminster has a veto over the will of the Scottish people. And I think, I believe that's a legitimate position to have. And then to give that power back to the people of Scotland and let them choose. So if the membership like the sound of that and they want someone that's going to stand up to Westminster, then, you know, I would hope they would consider voting for me as their number one.
The third element was a plan to improve the SNP. So what does that involve?
Yeah. So there, a lot of people have approached me recently and said that they would like to go back to the structures that the party had a few years. It's not even that long ago, but it's a few years ago now, in terms of, you know, the, how the NEC is run, in terms of internal democracy. So I've put a whole plan online for people to go and have a look at if they're interested in that type of thing. And the idea is we'll go back to the structures we used to have. It will increase, you know, I've got some ideas for transparency, but it will increase that level of party democracy so that all the decisions, the big decisions, will go through the party and membership, that they're able to contribute policy, because I think there's been a frustration. We also have a problem where, you know, we choose policy, but then it doesn't get reflected by the government. So an example of that would be on currency. So in 2019 at conference, the membership of the party said that they didn't agree with the Growth Commission and the five tests and all that for moving very slowly to, or maybe never, to a Scottish currency. And they said, actually, no, we agree with the proposition that Tim Ridout's putting forward and we want a Scottish currency as soon as possible. But I'm the only person in this contest that's reflecting that. But that is the SNP party policy. We also have an issue with transparency. So we started this conversation with me telling you that I didn't know how many members we had. So I would like to publish that information, you know, maybe on a quarterly basis, and publish how much money the party has, you know, so everything's upfront and transparent so that everyone has confidence, you know, in the way things are being run and where we are. So I've made those kind of suggestions, and also about sharing good practice across the party, helping people to get involved, sharing skills and all that kind of stuff. So more way of kind of bringing everyone together, helping everyone get involved, being, you know, more accountable, more transparent. So it's an idea, I suppose it's modernization, if you like, sort of an overhaul of the way we're doing things.
And what about the relationship with the Scottish Greens? Are you comfortable being in a coalition with them?
I think that we definitely have issues where we're aligned. Obviously, independence would be the obvious ones, but there are a number of issues where we're not aligned. So the obvious one would be, well, for me, obviously not for everyone in government, would be gender, the gender recognition reform. Obviously, they were, you know, that was a significant issue of policy red lines, if you like, for them. I felt that if we hadn't have been in coalition government with them at the time, there would have been more wiggle room to perhaps accept amendments, you know, particularly amendments that would have prevented, you know, rapists changing, you know. So there were some serious issues of safeguarding that were not addressed. And possibly, I mean, we'll never know this now, but possibly had we not been in a coalition, we might have had more opportunity to address those. But I felt, you know, that because the Greens had a very hard line on this, they didn't want to accept any amendments of any kind. And that led to the position that we ended up in, where, you know, that I felt was a very flawed piece of legislation that's gone on to be blocked by the Section 35. Now, another one would be roads infrastructure. You know, the SNP has made some promises to people in the north of Scotland about dualling projects on various roads, so particularly the A9 and the A96. And, you know, Green policy on this is that I think they don't want to, you know, spend more money on roads. They would rather spend that money. They have different priorities and they would rather spend that money in other areas. I feel if the SNP have made promises about this for some time now, and I think we've had manifesto commitments on this for maybe 10 years or more, that we really need to be delivering on that, because otherwise you get yourself into a position where people feel they can't trust you anymore. And I'd always felt that we had a good level of trust with the public, and, you know, the public did trust us. If we said we were going to do something, that we went and did it. That's important in politics. So I've made a commitment that I, you know, if I'm the First Minister, that I'll put that on my, you know, my priority list for the first few days to get progress on that and get those projects moving. And also because of safety, you know, people are dying on those roads on a regular basis. You know, the safety record is appalling. And so we need to look at that as an important issue that we need to resolve. So there's a couple of areas there. So we are different political parties. You know, the SNP got 45% of the vote at the last election, the Greens got 4%. So I suppose what I'm saying is that we need to review this, make sure it's working for the SNP membership, and also is it working in terms of what we're delivering to the wider public? So I haven't managed to speak to you. I did ring Patrick Harvey. I didn't quite say the right thing on TV. I didn't quite finish what I should have said, which was I had called everybody, but not everyone had called me back. And I had called Greens, but they hadn't returned the call. So it would probably be good if I could get to speak to them. But I have seen reports in the media saying that they wouldn't work with me. So obviously we've got that. There's that dynamic is in there as well. And they said they wouldn't work with Kate or I. So, you know, because of our views on various things, they think that's a red line. So it may be the case that, you know, if Kate wins or if I win, we get to the coalition and then the Greens decide that they don't want to be part of it anymore. And that's up to them. You know, I would be happy to continue it, but I think it has to be right for the SNP and in terms of what we want to, you know, deliver for the people as well. Oil and gas obviously would be another area where we're maybe not quite as aligned.
And how do SNP members feel about the coalition? You know, how do they feel about Lorna Slater and Patrick Harvey getting more prominence than a lot of SNP leading politicians? Yeah.
Well, we haven't asked them for a while. So we haven't asked them since before the deal was struck. So I think there's an argument, and this is what I would like to do, is go back to the membership and let them help us review whether this is something that we should carry on with. But I think there is some, I'm picking up, I went to the Northeast first of all. When I first started the campaign, I went straight up to the Northeast because I had been picking up that there was disquiet up there in terms of the road projects, in terms of oil and gas. The messaging, you know, that was coming up from an SNP Green government had changed. And, you know, an industry, well, and a workforce, that's a better way to put it. A workforce is obviously a big workforce in Scotland, well-paid jobs, you know, that will be challenging to replace. It's not to say you couldn't replace them, you can, but it's going to be challenging. Felt, you know, I think that the SNP government had been previously supportive, but were perhaps not expressing as much support for them anymore. Now I wanted to sort of put a bit of clear blue water between me and that sort of sentiment, and to make the case to say that, you know, that workforce is very important to Scotland, it's very important to the economy, it's very important to communities up and down, particularly in the north and the northeast. And we can't stand by, shut down, you know, the oil industry in Scotland, throw everyone out of work when we haven't replaced it with real jobs, and then still be importing oil. You know, it's been produced in countries where they don't have the human rights record, the environmental standards and so on. To me, that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, but the Greens probably would not agree with me on that.
And what about the wider independence movement? Obviously, the SNP is really the by far the biggest player and by far the most powerful and influential and, you know, the party that brought Scotland to the brink of independence and may well yet get it over the line. But there are all sorts of other groups, the Scottish Greens and you mentioned it earlier, sort of socialist parties that are in favour of independence as well, and things like Wings Over Scotland. And, you know, there's a whole sort of diaspora, really. I mean, how do you feel about the SNP's relationship with other elements? I mean, are there parts of the wider independence movement that you think the SNP should be more involved with or less involved with?
My perception of this is that the SNP does not have a good relationship with the wider movement at the moment. And I want to change that because I see that as being important. You know, I came through the Yes, you know, the grassroots Yes campaign. That's one of the reasons I'm here, because that, you know, I got involved in the Yes campaign and I thought it was great. You know, I thought there was, you know, really good elements of that grassroots campaign that we should definitely build on for success for next time. And I'm very firmly of the opinion that Scottish independence is not about one person, and it's not even about one political party. You know, it's about everybody. And so I felt very strongly about that. And I actually have already started to reach out to different parts of the movement. So the other pro-ND parties, but also the civil side as well. So people that are involved in, there is a sort of an existing structure that's similar to sort of an independence convention type thing. So I've reached out to them. I've reached out to, you know, Believe in Scotland. I'm talking to, I haven't quite managed to set up the meeting, but I'm sort of talking to Scott, you know, and Asians for Yes. You know, so there's all these different groups that were involved last time. And I've started to try and reach out to people and talk to them. And they're all quite excited. You know, they're saying, no, you know, no, we haven't had anyone from the SNP who's called us to have these conversations. So I think it is really important. I think we should definitely be doing it. There was another part to your question, but I think I've forgotten what
I think,
it
I think
was.
I've forgotten it as well. But is it true? And I realize I'm going off Wikipedia here, so I'm a hostage to fortune. But is it true that part of what got you into this whole thing was that you were at a dinner party in 2012 with your husband, who presumed you were going to vote no, and that's what, in a way, sort of triggered you to look into it, and actually you were yes.
Yeah. So I was brought up in Scotland until I was 10, and then I moved down to England. So I think I did have a strong, because they always say you're more Scottish when you're away, don't they? They have that sort of cliche. Yeah. And I think that is true. So my parents were from Glasgow. I'd never lived there. I'd been brought up in Bigger until I was 10. And then we moved to Devon. And then I went to university in the Midlands and then lived in London. So I spent lived in England for a long time, probably about 18 years in total. And, but definitely had that sort of strong sense of Scottish identity and could recognize the differences perhaps between, you know, maybe Scotland and political differences between Scotland and England, and had a kind of a sense of that. And so I'd always felt that Scotland was a country, and, you know, had that sort of sense of Scottish identity being quite strong, but I hadn't matched that up to the sort of political desire for an independent Scotland, which obviously would be represented by the SNP as a political party, because I'd lived away for so long. And I guess I hadn't been watching it, although I was interested in politics, I hadn't kind of got into that point. So yes, we were out, and it was 2012, and it was that point where you had to know what you were, you had to have an answer to that question, you know, how are you going to vote? And my ex-husband now, we've split up subsequently, but I will say it wasn't to do with his political views. So he's English, my kids are half English, and people said to us, oh, how are you going to vote? And my husband's like, oh yes, we'll be voting no. And I said, hang on a minute. And I said, actually, I don't think I will be voting no. And yeah, I went off, just did a bit of research and came back, and I was like, yeah, I'm a yes voter. So then he encouraged me to get involved though. So he said, right, well, if you're interested in politics, this is the biggest thing that's going to happen in the Scottish political landscape, probably for decades, you should get involved. But I think maybe he thought I was going to get involved in the no campaign, and also I went and joined the yes campaign instead. So yeah.
He's obviously not here to defend himself, but do you think?
And also, I was just going to say, I forgot to say, that's what I was going to say about the unity thing. This is kind of a joke, really, but you know how all the pro-indie bloggers are always usually fighting each other to the death online, but I've even managed to unite them. So they think they're going to support me. So yeah, so I think that shows, you know, there's a bright future here for uniting the movement.
But you know, you after you got involved in the referendum campaign, you then become an MSP pretty quickly. You're in government soon after that. You know, you rose very quickly. Now you're standing to be the First Minister of Scotland. Do you think you'd have always gone into politics eventually, but in a way the referendum brought that date forward? Or do you think without it, perhaps you never would have stood for office?
I don't know the answer to that question. I now realise I was probably a weird teenager, in that I can remember exactly where I was when I heard the news that Thatcher had gone. Right, that probably makes me a weird 17-year-old, right? But you don't realize that at the time. You just think you're interested in politics. So yeah, I did a politics degree. I did international relations, which is like international politics. So I was definitely interested in politics. I definitely did think I would like to go into politics when I was in my 20s, but I didn't know anyone. So I didn't know MPs, or I wasn't a member of a political party. And I think I just didn't know how to get from where I was to, you know, where I needed to be. Didn't understand about how parties worked, or, you know, that a usual route in, for instance, would be to join and then work for an MP and then kind of, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. And so I had to get a job, and I just got a job in another industry and just carried on. So I didn't really think about it again for years. So I don't know. Probably not, because I think being involved in the Yes campaign gave me that sort of active politics. I had joined the SNP prior to that, actually. And that's how then I then started to understand how would you go forward? What would you need to do? You know, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know.
There's so many. I mean, in any career, in any life, there are various decisions that have unintended consequences. But let's say you'd have stayed in England.
Yeah.
And then had gone on your political journey there. And even if from afar you'd have agreed with Scottish independence, obviously the SNP wouldn't have been an option for you south of the border.
You're going to ask me what party I would be in if I was still living in England.
I'm such a predictable interviewer, but yes.
Yeah, well, we can go by how I used to vote. So yeah, when I was in England, I used to vote Labour. So if that gives you an idea, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, you know, there's so many, it's amazing how life can turn in a way. And mm-hmm. There's something really inspirational about it, that you can end up in all these different places and based on decisions that perhaps themselves weren't political. But your kids are obviously half English. Do they ever say to you, oh, mummy, don't dare you break up the United Kingdom. You know,
they're both pro ND. So they've just gone off to uni. So they went off to uni in September. So it's twins. They went off to uni in September. And they're not into politics, though, I will say that. So I did say to one of my sons, oh, I'm going to be appearing at a hustings in your university town. Would you like to come along? And I was told that he would just meet me later. That was okay. Then. Yeah. So not interested in politics at all. But yeah, they're both pro-independence. They both can see the rationale behind it. So, yeah.
And is it difficult being a parent, a politician in 2023?
I think balancing parenting with, you know, particularly younger children, and any job is tough. Any parent of small children will tell you that. It's tough. And I think we don't have as much support. And often the childcare falls to women. So it's often the mother that has to take time off work if the child is sick and can't go to nursery or whatever. So I think that, you know, it often only works if you've got a lot of family support around you, so that when you can't send the child to nursery, you've still got a backup because they can go to granny or something like that. So, yeah, I think it is challenging for sure. Yeah. Because mine are grown up now, they don't need that kind of constant input from me. You know, in fact, they very rarely phone. So I haven't, since they've gone off to uni, I haven't seen them very much. I've obviously done a good job. They're off and they're happily making their own way in life, which is the way it should be.
Well, they value their independence in more ways than one. They are independent in the truest meaning of the word. Ash, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you go, Ash Regan. If you're an SNP member, you've got a couple of weeks to get your ballot back in whichever way that you can. Presumably, you can vote electronically in post and text. I have no idea actually how the process is run, but hopefully that's been helpful. And of course, to the wider public as well. If Ash becomes First Minister, you can see how it would be different to Humza Yousaf or Kate Forbes and indeed Nicola Sturgeon. So the rest of the contest, I'm sure, will continue to be fascinating. And we will talk about it on the 3rd of April with Ruth Davidson live at the Duchess Theatre. Of course, Krishnan Gurumurthy is the next show on the 20th of March. And just a reminder, on the 17th of April, Jess Phillips. 22nd of May, David Blunkett. 5th of June, Philip Hammond, and more guests to be announced in the coming days. Follow me on Twitter at MattFord if you want to find out who those guests are first, because it always goes up there because it's just quicker. So thank you for downloading this. Please leave a 5-star written review, share it amongst your family, friends, and the wider public, and I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.